All right, boys, just listen up for a sec. Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
How does that sound make you feel? Give me some adjectives.
It's nice. It's kind of like reassuring. Steady.
That sounds like a very accurate kind of... I really like the sound of that mechanism.
It's very precise, isn't it?
Yeah. It also makes me feel like I should be somewhere that I'm not. Like I'm in a rush or something.
What have
I
forgotten?
Kind of running late. But it does sound very nice.
I think all of that is very valid, boys. But let me tell you, this is the sound of a British-designed mechanical timepiece from the talented team at Marlowe Watch Company, sponsors of this episode. And with Marlowe, each collection is influenced by a historical story of inspiring human endeavour. Now, I've spent some time at their HQ recently because, well, I'm curious about mechanical timekeeping and also how things work. And I can tell you that there is so much very pleasing attention to detail that goes into each and every watch design. Now, these guys are serious about their watches, and you can tell by looking at some of the watch reviews online. I mean, the words quality and value come up time and again. Visit marlowewatchcompany.com to see for yourself. Marlowe Watch Company, time well spent, which I also like to think could be said for this podcast. Right, hopefully I've got everything. I'm on my way. For any potential burglars listening, this is a pre-recorded podcast, so if you're thinking of breaking in, I'm probably home. As per usual, a little bit behind schedule, so I have to get a bit of a jog on to the station. I wish I was more like Jono. Made it. Oh, thank goodness. I've got 3 minutes before train leaves.
So I was trying to understand if it was an official change or just a short-term change, because she hadn't made that clear to anybody. How long have we got on the clock? It's about 5 hours or something, isn't it?
I think about 2.5 hours.
2.5 hours.
What?
How long does it usually take for one episode?
Oh, about 8 hours.
All the dumb insects got squashed on the windscreens and all the smart ones.
Exactly, they've just worked out you've got to fly above cars and not through them.
Catch.
There it is.
Oh. We're not expecting an accident, so if you hear the horn, please call the emergency services.
Not planes, not trains, but automobiles. This episode's all about life on the road. Hello and welcome to Sketchplanations, the podcast. Crawling, walking, running, riding a donkey, riding a horse, riding an elephant, riding in a horse-drawn carriage, the bicycle, the tricycle, the... whatever happened to ricycles? The motorbike, the truck, the train, the hovercraft, the ski, and of course, the roller skate. All means and methods that humans have evolved to get themselves and their stuff across land from A to B. But hang on, something's missing in this list. The motor car. La voiture. Das Auto. Ever since Carl Benz designed and marketed the first series production automobile in 1886, the world has never looked back. I'm Rob Bell, past first time. Up in the passenger seat, reliable, sporty, and not just a little bit sexy, he's the Porsche 911 of audio. It's Jono Hay. And here in the back with me, he's fast. He's a one-off. And he's sometimes impossible to control. He's the Bloodhound Land Speed Project of podcasting. It's Tom Pellerow. Hello, gents.
Hello, everybody. And good afternoon. It's afternoon. It's lovely outside.
I know. Well, look, something's different, isn't it?
Yes, a bit.
Very.
Firstly, we're all together in the same place for only the second time in our short podcasting history. But more importantly,
yes,
we're in a car on the motorway.
We are in a car.
Getting some funny looks.
Yeah, we've just overtaken Tottenham Hotspur's coach, in fact.
Where are they off to? So Tommy, what's going on? Why are we in this situation for the podcast this week?
So brilliantly, we are all going away together. We're meeting a number of other friends and we're going for an activity weekend of cycling, mountain biking up in Buxton, which can't wait.
Yeah, lovely. Now, it's very important for me to stress at this point that we have a willing and able driver in charge of all the mirrors, signals and manoeuvring. And that will be making sure we don't impede his operations at any point. Ben, say hello.
Hello.
There he is.
Ben,
I mean,
I
say willing and able, yeah. Did you pass your test first time?
I did.
He did.
It obviously doesn't say anything about how good he's driving.
Why? Why am I so surprised in the back? That is a genuine surprise. Anyone? I mean, we're all very comfortable in your very spacious Volvo XC90. Ooh, Ben, I have to say, it's probably one of the best vehicles to record a podcast in from an audio perspective. I mean,
it's brilliant. It's spacious.
Volvo don't seem to market that much, though, do they?
We should be in their adverts.
Yeah. Driving podcasting.
Driving podcast. Yeah.
This is the Podmobile at last.
At last to the Podmobile. I mean, it's obviously going to sound a little bit different for you, our listeners, because we're doing the podcast in the car. But, you know, relax into it. Come with us on the journey. Enjoy the ride.
I'd expect a lot of people will probably be listening in the car, though. So maybe we're making it a complete experience.
That's a good point. Ben, do you ever listen to Sketchplanations, the podcast, when you're driving?
No, I don't. I do listen to the podcast.
Oh, okay. Hang on. Could have been...
Way to set him up for that.
Now, I mentioned the Bloodhound Land Speed project in my intro there. Do you know what the current land speed record is, anyone?
I know it was something like 594.
Okay.
But I think that was broken, and the Bloodhound were trying to get to 800 or 1,000.
Yeah, they were trying
to get... I think they got to something very high.
Sorry, what is the Bloodhound?
So the Bloodhound is, you know, it's an engineering... I guess it's almost entirely academic, right? Engineering project with loads of different companies coming together.
It's down in Newquay.
It's this jet-powered vehicle that you race across the sands, flats, basically, and get as fast as you can. And the current effort is going into something called the Bloodhound project, which was really kind of gaining guns before the pandemic. And then I think that put a bit of a...
Yes. And I presume a lot of the Virgin Galactic team, who are based at Newquay as well, are probably from the Bloodhound project.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Because it's all from Newquay, from that airport there. And I think it was Noble.
Yeah, it was. Was it Richard Noble? Was that
Yeah.
He came to speak. He did the chief keynote when we graduated,
yes,
right?
Because at the time he was talking about air taxis.
He was. He was. I remember that talk.
I went to school with his daughter.
Did you? Little input from Ben.
Check this out. We should do this with the crowd more often.
Wow. So the current holder of the outright world land speed record is, it was another project similar to Bloodhound called Thrust SSC. It's a twin turbofan jet powered car. And it was driven by Andy Green, who I think is still involved in the Bloodhound. That achieved 763 miles per hour.
700.
Imagine being in that.
Imagine.
You're not
that,
doing
right?
that on the M1 today.
Well. And they do it over 1 mile, and that was back in October 1997. Now, Tommy, you mentioned that. Do you know how long the journey we're doing today would take at that speed? So we're doing 139 miles, and according to Google Maps, it's going to take 2 hours
long.
And 42 minutes. It's how long would it take?
25 minutes.
10 minutes and 54 seconds.
Amazing.
I mean, the only thing is
it would take you a long time to stop, though. You'd have to start.
You'd end up in Edinburgh.
Yeah, yeah.
Terribly fuel efficient, I should imagine.
Yeah. Has it been past driving test first time? Same with me, yeah. Tommy?
Not first time.
Ah.
No.
Second time?
No. Yeah, we've got quite a long time in this car. Yeah,
how long have you got?
I was fourth.
Was
fourth.
Really?
Which is quite staggering.
Great. Okay. Yeah, Jono?
Yeah. Yeah, passed first time.
Obviously. Obviously. I don't know why you even bother asking.
He wrote the test.
Does that mean we should feel safer driving with Tommy because he's
a lot more practice.
Really learned, yeah, all
yeah.
that practice. Okay, look, the lights have turned green. We've checked our mirrors, and the pedestrians have cleared the crossing. Let's drive.
Did you know that before?
What? No, I didn't. I was hoping that someone
I should have just said off. First.
My money was on Noel's.
Four. It became such a big deal. Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I was like 25.
Oh dear. This week, back by genuinely popular demand from last series, we're going to bring you another quickfire episode. And nothing if not topical, we're going to cover a sub-collection of Jono's sublime sketches that feature or focus cars and driving, complete with sound effects left, right and centre. I'll list all of the sketches that we cover in the podcast description so you can follow our journey as we go from stop to stop. And needless to say, you can find all of Jono's sketches at sketchplanations.com. Thank you for all the correspondence you've continued to send in. We'll be going through some of those at the very end of this episode. And we'd love to know what you have to say about anything we talk about here. I mean, driving can be quite an emotive subject, shall we say. So I'm sure you'll all have a lot to say about it. And send your emails to
hello@sketchplanations.com.
Thank you, Tommy. Right then, Jono, do you want to kick things off for us?
I'd love to. The one I wanted to kick off with was something called Marchetti's Constant. It's one of my favourite sketches, actually, and it's just such a cool thing, I think. Such a really interesting observation, which is basically that as we manage to travel faster and faster, so by that I mean we went from, you know, we used to walk everywhere to eventually, you know, we had horses and then trains and subways and cars. The constant is that we maintained our average travel time of about an hour's travel a day, no matter what that is. And so what that meant and what that is in the sketch is like a little diagram showing the radius in kilometers of Berlin as it expanded alongside our means of travel. And the means of travel was it went from electric trams to subways to cars. As they got faster, Berlin could essentially get bigger. But we weren't spending less time traveling each day. As our speed of travel got faster, the city just got bigger. It just enabled a constant journey time on average of about 30 minutes in and 30 minutes back. And there are a couple of other like really interesting observations alongside that. For example, if you looked at ancient Greek cities which had, you know, walls on them, they were about 2.5 kilometers, and at 5 kilometers an hour if you're walking, that was about half an hour in and back,
like from one side of the city to the other type thing, or from to the extremity, like as far as
the radius. Yeah. If you're going from the outside to the inside, it would take you about 30 minutes. And then there's this observation which was, even people in prison for a life sentence who've got nothing to do and nowhere to go still walk around for about an hour a day in the open. So I think it's just so interesting that even though we managed to speed up our transport over the last century or two by so much, we're still just traveling about the same time.
It's good, isn't it?
I wonder if now a lot of people are working from home 2 or 3 days a week.
Oh, yeah.
If it's been averaged up over a week, and the fact that if you're only going in to the office 2 or 3 times, you're therefore prepared to go quite a lot longer, so it sort of averages out across the week, maybe.
I mean, that's one of the beauties, isn't it, of more working from home. You're getting all that time back. Well, I say getting it time back. It depends how you use that time, whether actually some people probably quite enjoy the commute because it's a bit of quiet time, a bit of alone time, nodding from the front of the car.
My cousin works for himself, and he used to live about 10 minutes away from his work, and his wife was like, it's just not long enough for you to decompress. You come back and you start talking to me like I work for you. She was like, you've got to move your office further away because you need that kind of half hour of chilling out so that we can have a, you know, relationship. And maybe that's a part of it.
I know, Jono, you're very good at making good use of your time on your commute. I know you're normally, it's with your nose in a book. Is that right?
I try as much as possible. Yeah, it's nice reading time on a commute, or it can be, depending on what you're doing, or if you're driving now, you might listen to audiobooks. I remember my wife had a commute where she used to do all her reading, and then she got a new job, which was essentially just around the corner, and she found she just didn't read anymore and really missed it, that reading time. And of course, in principle, I suppose, if you've lost that time, you can just get up earlier and spend it reading, but nobody does that. It's funny, isn't it? You appreciate it when you do it, but you don't actually make time for it yourself. But there you go.
I currently drive as part of my commute, which means I'm on the phone the whole time. I phone my sister one day, my other sister, my parents, friends, someone like, whereas Sarah commutes on the train and she can't phone anyone, so she finds she can't talk to her mum at all. Like, it's really difficult for her to find a space, whereas I talk to my parents a couple of times a week, every week. It's lovely.
Yeah, you're making use of that time.
Can I just say before we move on with this, because I think it's an interesting thing generally with technology, and in principle, technology made us more effective. In this case, it made us faster. But there is a bit of a history of whenever we put like these labor-saving appliances, like washing machines, dishwashers, and better vacuums or whatever, actually we don't spend less time doing the chores. We just do them more often.
More often.
Yeah. And so even though you've added more power to be able to do all these things, we haven't necessarily managed to make our lives easier.
So I wonder, Johnny, you know, we were talking about previously about the number of friends that you could have, your friend circle. And I wonder if with technology now, sort of Facebook, and it, where you can communicate with more people, that has also filled that gap a little bit more, or stretched that previous rule in a similar way to how this is stretched.
I guess that, it's a similar principle, isn't it? It is a similar principle, the use of technology to improve the efficiency of an activity, whatever that might be. And instead of you having more time from those efficiencies, you just fill that time with more of that activity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the amount of like WhatsApp chats you might be on, can definitely believe that.
And it's interesting. So all three of us live in and around London. I mean, London's a big place. I mean, in my view, and I think you touched on this in the sketch as well, actually, Johnny, that the hour is probably a bit more in London.
Yeah, but London is unfortunately, or at least it was when I did the sketch, a bit of an outlier of an hour and a half each day.
I mean, I'd say when I leave the house, if I've got something going on somewhere else in London, it's basically an hour there and an hour back.
Yeah. When was this research based on, Johnny? Because it feels that it's like half an hour is the ideal commute time, but a lot of people are much more like 45 minutes to an hour each way.
Or is that just because what's what we know in London? I'm sure other huge metropoli around the world have similar findings as well, that maybe it goes up a little bit. But I reckon on the whole that the hour or half hour there, half hour back is about right.
Well, it was based on Berlin, but
yeah.
I hate commuting. I really don't like it.
I just had to get that in.
I've managed to, for a long period of my life, I basically didn't commute. I managed to get my work within 5 minutes walk, and I used to love that. Like, my record was 45 seconds to work, I think, once.
What?
That was just amazing. Not in the same building. But it does mean I get to speak to my family, which is really nice, but commuting, it's a struggle.
Right, this is a quick fire episode, so let's move things along. Tom, we're going to come to you next. What have you got for us?
We are now moving on to Use of the Horn, sketch 348 for those collectors out there. firstly, it's unintended and intended. And unfortunately, whilst on the commute, I do find this can slip out with myself. It's those things which happen and you sort of say something or you react in a way that you might not really mean to, but often it sort of comes out. And I think there's a great book called The Chimp Paradox, which I'm sure both of you heard of. If you haven't read it or heard of it, The Chimp Paradox is a brilliant, brilliant book to read. And I think his kind of framing of this would suggest that the red parts on these sketch, where you react quickly and you yell maybe at someone back, like road rage is one of the best examples of this. You're driving along the road, you're all being calm, and the kind of what the author would describe as the computer is in charge. You're in autopilot, right? And then someone cuts you up, and you're, and the chimp then kicks in, and the chimp is an aggressive, powerful part of you. And you might find yourself getting really angry and maybe like charging up behind them, maybe swearing. And then you're like, the human then cuts in, and you're like, oh my gosh, I almost charged into that person. What was I thinking? You know, and often times the human in this framing sort of spends a bit of time apologising for some of the bad behaviour of the chimp that could come in. So Use of the Horn is a very good representation of this. And sometimes we all can have it. I suspect Jono never has this because he's always incredibly calm.
I can't remember. Doing those, but I guess one of the things I wanted to show in this was basically like that, although the horn is meant to like warn people that there's about to be an accident or something like that, the majority of the use of the horn is
in the
actually
UK
in the UK for other purposes. One is like just like expressing your dissatisfaction at what somebody else just did. Another one is to tell the car in front that the light's gone green and that they should move. And the last one is like, you know, hey, I've turned up outside your house, come on out. And there's only a small proportion of horn usage, which is actually what they probably had in mind when they
Well,
on that note, can I bring up rule 112 of the Highway Code?
Ah.
In the UK.
Which you just happen to be flicking through.
Well, yeah. I never go anywhere without it. We're on the car, Tommy. Come on. Preparedness.
Right next to my driver.
I mean, it's very clear on the purpose of vehicle horns. So they're only to be used in order to warn another road user of your presence. So that means you should never greet, you should never honk as a greeting or as an expression of annoyance, as you say. So you must not use your horn while stationary on the road, rule 12 goes on to say. And when driving in a built-up area between the hours of 11:30 p.m. and 7 a.m, except when another road user poses a danger. That's it. That's rule 112.
Do you find you used your horn?
Rarely.
I almost never think of...
The only time I do, and I do have to think twice before I do it, is to give someone a beep at traffic lights if they haven't seen it. Yes. And I do think, I don't really want to do this.
So I wish there was a more pleasant version of it.
Yeah. Well, Jono, what I love in your little description of the sketch is that you talk about it being an almost caveman-esque communication method.
Yes. It's so blunt, isn't it?
Yeah.
The verbal equivalent would be, oi!
That's all we can apparently manage.
And I bet there's some kind of law meaning that there can't be slightly more pleasant horns, that it would be dangerous.
You think of, like, you know, the development of emojis that went from like a smiley face and angry face to like about a billion emojis.
Mm. Yes.
And a horn is still just like, you're either shouting at somebody at the top of your voice or you're off.
Yeah.
Remember, its intended use is just to go, hey, I'm here, look, watch out.
Yeah. Have you been to India much?
Well, yeah, this is a good point for me. Yeah.
Because this is just constant.
Different rules.
Little beep, beep, beep. Yeah. It's a very different method of driving.
Yeah. And I've noticed that when I've been in, I think, Thailand and Vietnam. Yes. It's different cultures of use of the horn, right?
Yes.
I remember, I think it was in Lima in Peru, which... realizing that when the light was red, it didn't mean that you couldn't go through it. It just meant that you had to go through it hitting your horn. And that was the difference. But traffic keeps moving. It's quite funny. It
does. Well, I'm happy to report that so far we haven't had to use it in the car. Ben is keeping everything cold. Chimp is safely locked away in his cage. And we have human Ben in control of our safety.
We're not expecting an accident. So if you hear the horn... Let's call the emergency services. I mean, I've often thought, like, if you're going really slowly in a car, and we have this because we bought an electric car, and it's very quiet, and it's often that people, you know, as expected, don't necessarily hear you coming if you're coming slowly from a car park, and you basically need a bicycle bell. And I've thought about, like, having a bicycle bell.
Amazing.
You know, on the rear view mirrors or, you know, the side mirrors, and just, like, going a little ding.
Oh, that would be lovely.
And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to use the horn and threaten them and make them jump out of their skin. You know?
I know what to give Johnny for Christmas now.
Yeah. That is lovely. I wonder if you can get plugins for your to change the noise. Well, you definitely can change the noise of your car horn, can't you?
I wouldn't be surprised if it's illegal to do.
Yeah, it probably is. You can give it one if you want, Ben.
Probably. It's quickfire.
There it is.
The car next door has just slowed down a bit.
Yes, right, quickfire round. Thanks, Tommy. Use of the horn. Hopefully that's clarified stuff for everybody. I liked the sketch. Time you're passing on an inside bend. Right, so this is about... We're on a motorway now. It's a multi-lane highway. And we have options of which lane to be in. I mean... I say that, again, the Highway Code talks about, actually it's the outside lane, the left-hand lane is the driving lane, which you should be in the whole time, unless you're overtaking, in which you move out. And then you use the other lanes outside of you then, we've just moved back a lane. you use the other lanes for overtaking, and then when it's all clear, you come back. But what you can do to assist with that is use an inside bend. This comes back to classic physics. Speed equals distance over time. So if you've got a shorter distance to go on the inside of a bend at the same speed, you will do it in a faster time, and you can get past cars that are in front of you that are maybe going at the same speed or probably slightly slower, which is why you've caught up with them in the first place. But if you don't really want to accelerate to above the speed limit to get past them, what you can do is just wait for that bend, then go for the overtake on the inside of that bend, and you should get past them much quicker than you would if you're waiting on a straight road, because it does always feel a bit weird when you're overtaking somebody with a net difference of plus half a mile an hour. It for me, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, you're crawling past them, and I don't know, the inspiration for this for me was, yeah, that scenario where you're basically going just a tiny bit faster than the person in front, but not enough to like get around them quickly. And I don't know if you've ever had the opposite of this, was where you go to overtake somebody who's already going quite fast, and you go round them, but then the bend goes the other way.
Yeah.
And now you're in the outside bend, and actually you're not overtaking them at all, you're going backwards.
Yeah.
And you're going faster and faster, going, oh, this is faster than I wanted to be, and you're not going overtake. So it was a really dumb, simple thing, isn't it? Just like on a running track, taking the inside line is much faster, so wait for those sometimes. It can really help.
I must hasten to add, though, that this is not applicable on single lane roads, where overtaking on a bend is a stupid idea at any time.
Yeah.
Just wanted to make that clear. Something I occasionally do on multi-lane highways, if it's late at night and you've got a long journey, what I tend to do if there's nobody about is actually just take the inside line when I'm not overtaking, just to have a shorter road, have a shorter route, save fuel.
Use the road.
Use the road, it's there. It's not its intended purpose of the lanes, but...
Save battery in your case.
Exactly. Does anyone else do that?
I do that.
You do?
Yeah.
If you look
behind in the mirror, there's nobody around at all.
Yes.
Then you can just sort of go the straightest line.
Exactly.
Keeping to the lanes roughly, you know.
And if it is late at night, what I also find that it helps you stay focused as well, because you're always looking out for people behind you. Like more than you might do if you weren't switching lanes the whole time. That's my one. I love it. I think it's great.
Cool.
Thanks for the sketch, Jono.
When you say that's my one, as in Jono,
they're all Jono sketches.
Okay.
I can't sketch for Toffee.
I did that one. You know, I helped Jono out on a couple of these. No.
All right, cool. The next one's dead simple. It's a really straightforward point. Basically, I read in an article, and it had a few things, because in London, at any rate, there's a couple of places which have introduced like a no idling boroughs, for example.
Yes.
So you're not allowed to sit out on the street or outside a house and idle. And in particular, the thought was like idling around schools, for example. That was, I think, the first place where some of these signs came up for it.
Mm.
And the article talked about the idea that actually every minute an idling car can produce enough exhaust emissions to fill 150 balloons.
Man.
And
wow.
Yeah.
A minute.
It was really just... because a minute's not that long, right? If you're sitting there waiting for something. And I can understand that, you know, if it's really cold, people will keep their engine on to keep the heating on, for example. But if you imagine 150 balloons of exhaust coming out of the back of the car... Every minute. I was just trying to go, well, what does that look like? And I actually drew 150 balloons for this. And some of them wouldn't quite fit on the sketch, which is more or less very roughly to scale. And it's just a remarkable amount. And so, obviously, places are introducing no idling regardless. But as a way for me just to go, oh, yeah, that is actually really quite a lot. Maybe I should consider turning my engine off. That was what really the sketch was about. Just trying to visualise. Because it's so... I always think that exhaust emissions... Like, you never... you see them occasionally. But most of the time, you don't see them at all. And so I just thought it'd be really interesting. Imagine if out of every car right now...
Yeah.
...were balloons of exhaust and they were going up. Like, wouldn't that be a fascinating little visual to see. Imagine from a busy motorway, all of these balloons of exhaust coming up. And obviously the message here is about idling and not seeing outside on the streets by your house, for example. But yeah, interesting way of visualizing, I think.
It is. And you know, with a lot of messaging around sustainability and fuel efficiency and climate change, it's really difficult because we can't see it, right? We can't see those emissions. And so any way to help visualize that does help people's understanding of it. It is a phenomenal number, those 150 balloons. But I think what's important, well, what I'd like to talk about with this is that within those emissions, you've got your climate change gases.
Yeah.
But then you've also got the pollutants for air quality as well. And they are kind of two different things. And in a big city like London, yes, climate change is always an issue, but air quality is becoming an increasingly significant issue for people's well-being, people's health.
Of that balloon that's coming out, I wonder how much of that is CO2 in that balloon, how much of it is other, you know, carbon monoxide, soot, other bad things, and how much is just water vapor and air, you know, nitrogen that's coming out. I'd be interested to know how much of that balloon.
Yeah. And to be fair, I don't know. And actually, you know, a number of people asked me when I first posted this, well, you know, what size are the balloons? And it depends on the temperature of the gas coming out. And these are all fair questions. I feel like it's a normal size balloon, but and you might well be right. There's a bunch of it's fine, but I do know that I wouldn't like to be breathing the stuff that's coming out of a car's exhaust, no matter what. So
one statistic I do have, which is related, is that nearly half of air pollution in London is due to road vehicles.
Wow.
So it doesn't answer your question, but it does.
Yeah.
It does kind of set that up a little bit more. And Jono, as you said, we've got kind of pedestrianised zones, no idling zones. You've got lower speed limits now, more in London. I could keep talking about London because that's what I know. There's obviously congestion charging and ULEZ, highly controversial at the moment, but you know it does a job for air quality. And technology does move along as well. You have start-stop technology with a lot of vehicles as well now, with traffic lights.
It's so brilliant the way that cars automatically turn off so quickly now. I really love that.
So apparently cars around 10 years old use more fuel when they start up than just idling after about 10 seconds. So 10 seconds is like the rule. If you're going to be stopped for more than 10 seconds, then turn it off. But modern cars, that doesn't apply. So the start-stop technology works really, really well.
You know, I put a little note in the description. I said, but if you have an electric car, this won't apply. And I got a bit of stick for it. As if I was implying that everybody can afford an electric car. And of course, I was just saying that it doesn't do any emissions. I didn't mean that at all. But that's what I was going to say. I'm not implying that everybody can go buy an electric car.
Absolutely. You know, we're just talking about reality here. This is what happens. I do get quite angry when I see people just idling.
Yeah.
And so I saw someone at the supermarket the other day. It was a hot day and there was a guy in the car. He wasn't actually parked in a car park space. He was parked right outside the supermarket. So you know, obviously somebody who was with has popped in for something quickly. So my assumption is he had the air conditioning on and he had a seat right back and he was asleep. I was very tempted to go and bang on the window, wake him up and say, "Oi, turn your engine off, son." I didn't.
Yes.
But it made me angry for about 2 hours afterwards.
So you and I spent quite a lot of time in Canada and America. In Canada especially, they would leave their cars on a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's so
massive
cold.
Trucks. And partially because it's so cold, partially because they got so much fuel, partially it was just a thing. And I really struggled in these lovely parts, especially where you've got these trucks, small trucks, big trucks, left idling. It was like, come on, turn it off.
It is annoying.
The noise, the emissions, it's just wrong.
That said, though, I bet we've all done it once or twice when it's really cold or it's really hot and you just need a bit of escape from the
And when the temperatures get to minus 30 in Calgary, you can understand. So it's all...
I think the one which I think really needs to happen is ice cream vans.
There is something about these, though, in the fact that the ice cream van engine is actually providing the ice cream.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have, like, queues of kids standing outside the window of a vehicle
sucking up the fumes
all day long. Like, it doesn't make sense to me, but I'm sure it will change. But
the engine is actually providing the ice cream. It's making the ice cream.
I think what we're saying is, let's start a Sketchplanations the podcast campaign for ice cream van drivers to convert to electric. I'm not going to say that because you'll get even more people emailing Jono.
Well, no, I mean, I think you'll look back and you'll be like, this is mad.
I've got
20 kids queuing outside this thing and I don't care if it's making the ice cream or not. Find another way to make the ice cream.
Find another way. I watched a programme about ice cream machines. And what I didn't realise is, so the compressor, you know, the Mr. Whippy that sort of makes it as you pull the handle down?
Yeah.
That ice cream is being made from water and air simultaneously, basically, as he pulls the handle.
Okay.
And that requires a huge amount of compression to do it. And there's an American guy invented this compressor to do it. But the amount of power you actually need to create that was... it resulted in this huge machine. And this British guy invented a way of basically using the truck's engine to provide the power to do it.
It's very clever.
Which is a clever idea, which is why ice cream trucks with the Mr. Whippy could be created in the first place, kind of thing. Now, I agree, Jono, it is horrible when you're at a beach and there's an ice cream van and the lorry's just on and there's fumes coming out the back and you're getting ice creams on the side. I completely agree, but it isn't just because they've left the air, you know.
I wasn't blaming it, I was just saying it's a bit crazy.
And I don't know if they can do it with a... well, I'm sure they could.
We've
do it with
put men on the moon, for goodness sake. Surely we can find a way of making Mr. Whippy ice creams with less energy.
With less energy or with greener energy. As you say, there must be a way of doing it with greener energy.
Anyway, this is quick fire. We're getting off track.
If you want to listen to our episode on Mr. Whippy ice creams...
Mr. Whippy ice cream?
Oh, can we do an episode where we're eating Mr. Whippy ice creams or any ice cream?
That's right. The beach episode. Let's move on. Jono, thank you. Idling cars. Tom, we're going to come to you. What's your second choice of sketches relating to cars or being on the road?
The Doppler effect. Now, the Doppler effect is that thing that when a police car, an ambulance is coming towards you, the sound coming out of the siren makes a different pitch, a different noise as it's coming towards you in comparison to when it's going away from you. And that's because the speed of the car is being added to the speed of sound. And Jono, I really hope that I'm not destroying that.
That's not a bad description of the Doppler effects. It is the phenomena of... the best example, a siren, as it comes past, it changes pitch, and that's the sound waves being squashed towards you as the source of the siren comes closer, and then being stretched as it heads off a further distance past you.
It's also got a very cool name, just Doppler, just sort of... Does it, Robbie?
It's named after the Austrian physicist who discovered it.
Which is lucky.
Christian Doppler.
Yeah. It just sort of seems to fit with the kind of... wave and sound in my mind. Cool.
There's an interesting little anecdote about its discovery though. So yeah, so discovered by our Austrian physicist Christian Doppler in 1842, the theory of which, but it was a Dutch mathematician who has an even better name, Christoph Hendrik Diedrich Beisballet, who successfully proved the Doppler effect using brass musicians on board a steam train in 1845. So someone with a trombone or a trombone on the steam train, in it comes, as it comes through the station, and then people on the station observing it as it comes in and heads off. And I think they measured it as well. Brilliant. There's a brilliant little video clip on the BBC website you can see about this as well. It's fantastic.
Experiments.
It's fantastic.
I think trains are really interesting because before the invention of trains and train travel,
yes,
it was quite difficult to do any of those kind of experiments. You imagine you're like somebody trying to run along and play a brass instrument, or somebody on the back of a horse,
yeah,
trying to, like, we just didn't have
not
like steady travel in a straight line to test things about like acceleration and speed.
Before trains, no one had ever gone beyond the speed of a galloping horse.
Well, let's say
there was such concern that all our brains were going to get splattered out when you got to kind of 50 miles an hour and we'd all die.
Some great evidence of this is obviously in Back to the Future 3, 1885.
Yes.
You need to get up to 88 miles per hour. There's no fuel in the DeLorean, so what are you going to do? You've got to stick it onto train tracks and figure it out that way.
Wait for the trains to arrive. As you say, highly scientific evidence there.
Highly scientific evidence. And
from
had you been there, you would have witnessed the Doppler effect as it came past.
Yeah, I should say it's not just sound, though. It's just waves. It's a property of waves in general. Basically, if a wave is coming out of a source and it is coming towards you, it's basically catching up with the waves which it's sending out. And so they're becoming sort of squished in comparison. Yeah. And same opposite, if it's going away, they get stretched. And so it doesn't have to be like sound traveling through air. So the Doppler effect's used in all sorts of stuff. And it was used in It was used in some of like the early GPS things, and it's also used, you know, it's used in like speed cameras. And I remember I read a really interesting book about precision, I think it was, and it talked about the early experiments that led to GPS and some of the things where they put basically like a an emitter in the back of a car and drove it away, and by checking on the receiver how the pitch was shifted, you could tell the speed of the car, for
yeah,
example.
Cool.
And of course they do that in reverse when yeah. you have like a speed camera at the side of the road, like a speed gun, for example, that kind of thing. And so yeah, the Doppler effect as a whole has just had tons of different applications. I think it was also used, has some uses in like measuring the speed of the blood traveling through your veins. You can sort of shine rays into your body and see how the reflections are coming back differently based on the speed of the blood. All sorts of applications for the Doppler effect.
Very practical.
Right, moving on. My second one is about the piston. Interestingly, this is one of, I don't know if it's the only one, Jono, but it's one of very few sketches on Sketchplanations where you have an animation instead of a stationary sketch depicting the piston, a reciprocal motion back and forth, a piston inside a cylinder connected to a wheel. So the piston is brilliant for translating reciprocal motion into rotational motion. Yeah. And the animation is wonderful, John. Have you got any other animations up there?
I have
images?
Just a couple. I think I've got like three animations. And the plain facts is I'm not an animator. I don't use animating software all the time, and it just takes so much longer to do an animation than anything else. And I will say also, they're not always quite as practical. Like, it's great if your thing shows, whatever you're viewing it on, it shows an animation, but you know, you can't print it out and get the same thing. You can't put it on a poster or whatever and still get the same view. So anytime I've done something where I've had multiple frames, you still have to think about, okay, well, if this was a static image, what would it be? But I do think for the piston, it's quite nice. I quite like just loading it up and looking at it, yeah. going round.
It is. It's quite hypnotic. And it's so widely used, right, the piston. We're using them now. I don't know how many. Probably
there
six?
There are four.
Four.
Four, yeah.
Ben, as a non-engineer, are you aware of a piston and a cylinder? Kind of what the basics of what that is?
I think it's a basketball team, isn't it?
Ben's got three pedals.
I'm just interested because I know what a piston is because I've spent loads of time around them, and that's the kind of stuff I enjoy. But probably not everybody does know exactly what a piston is and how it works. So yeah, okay.
They are, and how they created the Industrial Revolution steam engine piston.
Yeah, incredibly, the first piston is thought to date back to around 150 BC. For use in metalworks, pumping air to create the heat to melt metal.
Yes,
and it's been been developed and pushed on. Yeah,
a syringe is almost a piston. Half of one.
But the piston here is where we're very much talking about reciprocal motion, back and forth.
Yes,
to get rotary motion.
Yeah.
Obviously, used in internal combustion engines is probably what we most know it for, where it's been refined and refined. So that you get more efficiency, more power, cleanliness of emissions.
For me, I think the genesis of bothering to do this sketch for me was reading one time that what a piston does is convert linear motion into rotational motion. And I just, I'd seen pistons on the side of steam trains and I knew that they were in cars, but I just never thought about it so clearly that you're just taking something which is going back and forth along a straight line, and what the piston does is it turns that into rotating a cylinder instead. And I just think that's really clever. And then if you take four of those and you time it all correctly and then get them all out, operating at the correct sync, then you have a car with constant movement. It's just really clever application of a super simple principle.
I think going back to driving tests, my driving instructor, when we're when you're in a manual car, you're changing gear, he taught me to think about the clutch plates coming together as I'm lifting the clutch pedal.
Yes.
And I did. I visualised that. And then I visualised that for ages. And as a continuation of that, a lot of the time I spent in the car when I had an internal combustion engine car was thinking about the different moving parts, the clutch plate, the piston, the suspension, what's happening when you go over a bump with your tyres and your wheels and brakes. Actually visualising what's going on. I mean, that's, I don't know, that's probably just me, I don't know.
You did end up as an engineer.
Yeah. But I just enjoy that visualisation. Yeah. So this sketch for me is lovely. It's just it's a lovely, simple engineering principle, isn't it? You can also use it the other way around, right? Rotational for linear.
Yes.
You turn a crank round and round and round, and what you get out is a linear back and forth motion. You can use that.
Yes.
Yeah, you can.
I believe
you. I'm trying to think of an application where you use it.
You might use it.
Much less common.
Like cutting. You're having something like a blade that's slicing back and forth.
Pump,
yeah, you might use. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. There are other methods for that. One's called a Scotch yoke, I think.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway.
Sounds tasty.
The piston. Have a look. If you don't know what it is, you'll know straight away. Let's move on. Should we go one more round each? Jono, we're back to you.
Yeah, so I was going to touch on something, really simple sketch. It was called the windscreen phenomenon. And I don't know if you've heard about it, but essentially it's a very tangible observation, and the sketch just has like essentially two trucks. And maybe it's showing my age, but like even when I started driving, and it's actually from before that, so the example gives 1970, if you were to go drive on the roads or the motorways then, it was a very common thing to be, if you were driving on a long journey, that your windscreen would get splattered up with dead bugs. And so a common thing, you stop at a service station and you clean your windscreen of all these bugs, or your headlights of the bugs. And I do remember some of that as a kid. And the windscreen phenomenon is that doesn't tend to happen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you go on a long journey, you won't tend to have to clean off loads of bugs from your windscreen.
Case in point, look ahead.
Yeah, it's a perfectly clean, clear windscreen with not a single dead bug on it, which obviously is sad for any dead bugs. But what it shows is that there are way fewer, potentially, insects, flying insects around than there were 30, 40 years ago. And insect numbers, I think, are quite a difficult thing, as you can imagine, to keep track of.
Very.
So, like, you know, how do you know how many of any particular type of fly there is around in the world at any one point? And the answer is it's very difficult to find out. But the windscreen phenomenon is this thing which really is gradual observation, that if you go driving now, you won't tend to have to clear off many windscreen bugs from your windscreen, whereas if you did that in 1970, you'd be all smeared up and you'd have to clean them off. So that's what it is. But it's about a potentially troubling decline of insect numbers.
It is in the wild.
Yeah,
I find it really interesting and want to know more about it because of that. What you're saying, Jono, that it is actually very difficult to measure.
Yeah.
This metric, and so it's something that's almost quite perverse way of trying to track it or have any kind of measurement or monitoring of it.
It's not the nicest way to measure it, but you know what? I often think about that of any like biologists or ecologists. Like, how on earth do you get the data on what these animals are doing? Like, I think, you know, we still don't know where, you know, blue whales go to breed or something like that. But, you know, these things are really difficult. You've got to, like, be there somewhere in the middle of the ocean at some particular day for that one. But, yeah, how do you count insect numbers? I don't know.
But with the windscreen phenomenon, yeah, we've got all of these cars on the road all the time. I read a couple of studies about this. There was one in Denmark between 1997 and 2017, through a concerted look at the number of dead bugs on windscreens along two stretches of the same road. An 80% decline was measured between 1997 and 2017. That was on this one road in Denmark. Maybe there were special considerations to take in there. And another one in the UK in 2004, 40,000 people attached sticky films to their license plates. And from that, it was kind of averaged out and concluded that you'd get one insect collision every 5 miles on average. But then they did it again in 2019, or the Kent Wildlife Trust did it again in 2019, 50% reduction in splats. And then the Kent Wildlife Trust did it again in 2021. It showed a 72% reduction since 2004. So, I mean, if you look at those two studies, a definite decline.
Yeah, so like, and I think, you know, insects are the base of the food chain in many ways. And so much eventually relies on them, just like plankton in the sea. It's insects on land and in the air.
And the plankton of the air.
Yeah, and so I don't know, when I read about this, I guess it's easy to think about insects as like pests or annoying, or they bite you, or what, they land on your food or whatever. But actually gave me a slightly different perspective actually to treasure them and realize how important they are. And actually you should be really, I mean, it seems really weird to say it, doesn't it? You should be really glad if there's loads of like flies buzzing around, or you know, lots of insects in some area. Nobody ever says that, but actually it's really important.
It's like a necessary inconvenience, right?
Yeah.
For a sustainable world.
As you said, John, I think it's very difficult to measure certain insect levels. It does seem to be pointing to the fact that there is a large reduction happened in the last 20 years and certainly probably last 50 years. There's also a lot more cars on the road. And so I wonder if that has any kind of effect. And what's hilarious is you could read into that insect intelligence has clearly increased significantly because they're that much better at dodging cars.
Read it as you wish.
Seems unlikely that is the case, but that is a sort of an example of how data has to be... obviously it's not that, but it could point towards that conclusion.
All the dumb insects got squashed on the windscreens and all the smart ones...
Exactly, they've just worked out you've got to fly above cars and not through them. And I do genuinely sometimes think about, you know, when are the animals going to kind of work some of this stuff out? Like, why are cats...
Why is it all down to humans to prevent the decline of the Earth?
How come? It's obviously it's well known as to why humans are improving in our intelligence and improving in stuff. But at the same time, you're kind of like, but the orcas recently, the killer whales, are one animal that do seem to be, having a bit of a go.
Is this the attacking
things.
The boats?
Yeah, yeah, and finding, and nobody really knows why they're doing it. But imagine though, if all the animals decided to fight back against us.
Including the insects. Christ. Doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
But we don't have to think about it because it's not really going to happen, but...
Well, so one proposed explanation for, at least in part, the reduction in insects is an increased use of pesticides in agriculture, I guess, and farming, and probably domestically as well, actually.
Yeah, very likely.
I did read another stat that with modern design of vehicles that are more aerodynamic than, say, 20, 30 years ago, actually, it was found the opposite, that the more boxy vehicles had fewer splats on their windscreen than the aerodynamic. I know.
Because the speed of the air, I suppose, around them was faster.
I don't know. That was part of the findings from the sticky license plate stuff they did down in Kent. Interesting.
Curious.
Right, let's move on. That was the windscreen phenomenon. Thank you very much, Johnny. Right, I'm going to round things off with a bit of advice to anybody driving. Tiredness can kill. Take a break. It's estimated around 4% of fatal road crashes and 2% of all collisions in Britain are down to fatigue at the wheel. There we go. There's a bit of braking going on, a bit of traffic. Thankfully, our driver, Ben, doing an expert job, by the way. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah.
This is great. Keeping his eye open. No tiredness there, despite the many miles he's travelled to pick us up. And still miles to go. We'll probably pull into services yet. But so those statistics, 4% fatigue responsible for 4% of... fatal road crashes and 2% of all collisions. Aww. It's likely that those factors are probably quite a bit higher though, right? Because it's very hard to test for, like the decline of bugs. It's very hard to test for fatigue, unlike drink driving or drugs or whatever else it might be.
It's funny though, isn't it? It's interesting that there's not a straight up tiredness test. I can't be like, I'm 50% tired. And you're objectively 60% tired.
Yeah.
Blood...
Yeah, there genuinely isn't any way of testing tiredness, is there? Like, you can do, you know, breath tests for alcohol.
Press ups.
Physical tiredness, yeah.
You can scale give them a multi. Here's an iPad, you've got to do this test.
It reminds me.
You're clinically knackered.
I did a really simple sketch of like comparing Fahrenheit and Celsius. And there's obviously stories behind the scales. But it's interesting to think that before you had those scales, stuff was either just hot or cold or really hot or really cold.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I say something's really hot, your thing might be way hotter, but who knows? Because there was no actual way to measure it. But we're still just like that with tiredness, aren't we?
We are.
Funny.
So what John very helpfully suggests in the sketch is that caffeine can help with that. Help keep you awake. But I guess you need to be aware of the effects of caffeine as well. Different for different people, how long that might be able to last. But typically when you're on the road, isn't it take a break every 2 hours on long journeys? Is that the recommended amount?
I believe so.
I don't know.
If you do take a break and you want some caffeine, that caffeine can take a little while to kick in. So you know, you could have a little nap.
Or get someone else to drive you. I really do like this. This is excellent.
Yeah. So I learned that it's called a nappuccino.
Nice.
Which is is like you drink the coffee, but it takes a little while for the caffeine to really get into the bloodstream and take effect and or wherever it goes. And so you drink the coffee, you sleep for 15 minutes, and that's given the coffee time to do its thing, and then you can carry on going. There's a sketch, I'll link to it in the comment, but talk about the half-life of caffeine, because, you know, the length of time that it stays in your body. So if you drink a coffee, it takes about up to 45 minutes to get the maximum effect of that, but then it takes a long, slow time for that to come out of your system, which is why they recommend not drinking too much coffee late in the afternoon, otherwise you won't get to sleep. Unless you're my parents, who can apparently have double espressos after dinner and they're fine. I don't know.
It's different for different people.
I don't know how they do that.
I don't mind a coffee late at night. There we go. Thank you. And good to end on some very sound advice on the road. Great. That was very fun, boys. Ben, how's that for you? Is our very willing and very able driver.
I'm still awake.
Definitely. He's still awake.
Get that guy a coffee.
Good start.
Ben, anything we've talked about there that you might consider differently now on the road? Or
one thing that's made me feel very guilty is the idling, because, I thought it would affect you more than most, Robbie. Because we sometimes, with our four-month-old and our two-year-old, idle them outside of the house if they're sleeping. Because if you turn the engine off, they wake up, and that's not going to happen again. I promise you.
Wow. Yeah.
When they start screaming, you can blame Uncle Rob.
Yeah, but what good is that going to do? I'm not there. Yeah, fair enough. Here we are on our high horse, actually quite high up in the horse of the Volvo XC90. It's a lovely driving position, I have to say. But yeah, everyone's got their stuff to deal with, right? Jono, Tommy, anything you want to add on what we've talked about on road issues, road safety, road worries, concerns? No.
Good question.
And now I know to leave long silences there now, because it just could be people thinking they don't have.
Do you know what? There was one sketch which I thought you would pick out. I won't go into it too much but it's really short. Which was that our sensors is the idea that our sensors are built to take in information at human pace. And I think it's a really nice observation from in the Art of Travel by I think Alan de Botton, who talks about. He talks about trains being just perfect for thought, but in general for our senses, in some ways, like being in a car, it's too fast to take in everything that's going on. He says that's quite a nice thing with the train, because you can't actually focus on the outside and what's happening, so you get to focus in on your thoughts. But the idea is that our senses actually take in information best at walking and maybe at cycling sort of pace, and beyond that you're not really engaged with the outside world. Anyway, it's a really simple sketch, but it's a really lovely point, I think, and I think about it quite often if you're whizzing along at 736 miles an hour in the Bloodhound or something, obviously you're not taking things in fully, versus if you go for a walk or a cycle, that's the way you take in your surroundings the best when you're traveling. There's another sketch. It's not directly related at all. I never actually connected it, but there's one about the middle floors being the best in apartment buildings.
I remember you talking about this when you lived in San Francisco in a high rise.
Yeah, exactly. And my experience was, if you're right on like the first or second floors, you're basically still fully connected to the road and the people and the things that are going on right outside.
Yeah.
And if you're right at the very top floors, you're completely disconnected from them, in that you might as well be in a plane just like looking down at a city on like a map. Whereas if you're in the middle, you're just connected enough that you can sort of see everything that's going on
and
associated with it. But it's also not enough to like disturb you in any way. You're disconnected from it. And it's actually, yeah, there's some parallels to the sort of speeds of travel there.
Hmm. There we go.
Anyway, there you go.
Food for thought. Food for thought. Well, that's 9 sketches on driving that we've covered there. 10 or 11, actually, if you count those last two. And as we're approaching our destination of Buxton here in the car, the podcast is also reaching its conclusion. What a ride. Thank you all very much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the series if you haven't already. And just like an Uber driver, you can always give us a rating too. That'd be nice. Please continue to keep winging your comments and messages our way as well. Always fun. And we'll be going through this week's postbag in just a minute. Next week, we'll be back to the standard single sketch format. And as this episode was a little bit of a bonus one for us, I'm not actually sure what's coming up next week. At the very worst, I'm sure it'll be fine. For now, we're going to pop into the next services. We've got 4 Nappuccinos on order. We'll find a place to park. Handbrake firmly on. Don't forget to bring the litter out with you, Tommy. Come on, mate. Until next week, stay well, go well. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Ben. Thanks for driving us, mate. Music on this podcast series is sourced from the very talented Frank Cinelli. And you can find loads more tracks at frankcinelli.com.